From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, the close-up, larger-than-life faces of contemporary artist Chuck Close. We'll talk with him about his paintings, which reveal his subject's every pore and wrinkle. A retrospective of his print work is now on display at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. Also, film critic David Edelstein reviews Starsky and Hutch, starring Ben Stiller and Owen Wilson. And TV critic David Biancooley on The Sopranos, which begins its fifth season on Sunday on HBO. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. A federal jury in Manhattan has convicted Martha Stewart of obstruction of justice and lying to investigators about a stock deal. Stewart's former stockbroker, Peter Bokanovic, was found guilty on all but one of the five counts against him. Stewart's attorney, Robert Marvillo, said he'd appeal.
We are confident that once we get our day in the Court of Appeals, the conviction will be reversed, and Martha Stewart will ultimately be determined not to have done anything wrong.
Prosecutors said that Stewart sold about $228,000 worth of stock in ImClone Systems after Bokanovic warned her that ImClone founder Sam Waksal was trying to sell his. A day later, the Food and Drug Administration refused to approve an ImClone cancer drug, causing the stock value to plunge. Members of Iraq's governing council have delayed today's signing ceremony for the country's interim constitution. It may now take place on Monday. NPR's Ivan Watson reports from Baghdad.
25 gold pens, one for each of the governing council members expected to sign Iraq's new interim constitution, lie unused on a desk in a ceremonial hall. This was supposed to be the unveiling of the most democratic legal code yet for the Middle East and the first step in a plan towards ending the U.S. occupation on July 1st. A council source says five Shia members boycotted the ceremony after issuing last-minute demands to change the document. A senior official with the occupation administration explained that democracy is messy and added that Washington will not force the members to negotiate a new agreement. Today's delay marks an embarrassing setback for U.S. plans in Iraq. Ivan Watson, NPR News, Baghdad.
The nation's unemployment rate stayed unchanged in February. Analysts say new jobs are scarce in an economy marked by increased productivity and globalization. NPR's Paul Brown reports.
The Labor Department says the unemployment rate stayed at 5.6% in February, with just 21,000 new jobs being added. Economists had been predicting 125,000 new jobs. John Sylvia, chief economist at Wachovia Corporation, said the February results are a further indication of structural changes in the world economy.
Economic growth today is being achieved primarily through productivity gains, which reflect real strong high-tech capital spending. And we're not getting it through employment gains. And that's, I think, the new reality of where we are now in a post-NAFTA, post-WTO economic world.
Manufacturing jobs fell for the 43rd consecutive month in February, but retailers, temporary help firms, and health services added jobs. Paul Brown, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials gained 7 points to close at 10,595 in active trading. The NASDAQ Composite Index lost 7 points to close at 2047. This is NPR News. A federal judge has blocked the Justice Department from gaining access to thousands of confidential abortion records kept by the City of San Francisco and Planned Parenthood. The Justice Department said it wanted the records as part of its defense of the Partial Birth Abortion Ban Act. The judge said that turning over the records would violate the privacy rights of the women involved. In Kansas, the state house has approved a proposed amendment to the state constitution banning same-sex marriages. As NPR's Greg Allen reports, the state already has a law banning gay marriage.
Supporters of the proposed amendment say they fear the law currently on the books banning same-sex marriages in Kansas could be overturned by a court, as happened recently in Massachusetts. The amendment would ban gay marriages and go further, denying benefits associated with marriage to other relationships. The move comes in response to publicity surrounding gay marriage ceremonies being performed around the country. If the amendment is approved by two-thirds of the state Senate, it would go on the ballot as a referendum in November's general election. Kansas's governor, Democrat Kathleen Sebelius, says because of the law already on the books, she believes a constitutional amendment is not necessary. More than 30 other states have laws banning same-sex marriages. More than a dozen are also considering strengthening their bans through constitutional amendments. Greg Allen, NPR News, Kansas City.
Attorney General John Ashcroft has been hospitalized for what doctors say is a severe case of gallstone pancreatitis. A Justice Department spokesman says Ashcroft is expected to spend several days in the hospital while the condition is treated. Doctors say the inflammation is painful but usually clears up with a week of treatment. In stocks, the S&P 500 gained 2 points to close at 11:56. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Reprise Records, presenting Neil Young and Crazy Horse's album Greendale, available in stores. Also on tour and in movie theaters now and on DVD this summer.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies of the Philadelphia Daily News, in for Terry Gross. Our faces reveal so much about who we are. That's part of what makes Chuck Close's paintings so fascinating. They offer the chance to stare at larger-than-life, hyper-realist renderings of faces. Faces transformed into what Time magazine art critic Robert Hughes described as moonscapes of pores, wrinkles, blackheads, and stubble. Close has been painting faces since the 60s, but it's remarkable he can paint it all now. In 1988, a stroke left him paralyzed from the shoulders down. After a partial recovery, he's able to work from a wheelchair. While he's famous for his paintings of faces, a retrospective now at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York displays his approach to his signature subject through another medium, printmaking. Terry spoke to Close in 1998. She asked him why the human face has been his subject for so long.
Well, initially I started making portraits, or at that time I didn't even call them portraits, I called them heads, because it was as different as possible from what I had been doing before. My work had been abstract, and I was looking for something that was diametrically opposed to what I had done as a student. And so the first heads were just my friends, and I had no idea then, 30 years ago, that I would still be painting heads today. And in fact, I'm sure I wouldn't have believed it if somebody had predicted it. But over the years, I found that of all the kinds of subject matter that I could use, nothing interests me as much as people. And it offers the viewer an entrance into the work through a life experience, because we all look in mirrors and look at each other and look at images in magazines and film. And it's a great leveler, whether a person is the most sophisticated person in the art world or a lay person. We all share that knowledge of and interest in the way people look. And then hopefully, once somebody gets into the painting, maybe through that the entrance of the life experience, they'll notice some other things that are going on in the paintings and become involved in that as well.
Let's try to describe what's happening formally in your paintings. Your paintings are built not of, like, big, elaborate brushstrokes, but of little dots or little circles. And it's the accumulation of all these dots or circles or squiggles, depending on the period that we're looking at, that kind of together add up to the larger structure of a face. But all the components are just really small dots or squiggles or bits
of there's
color.
There's no direct relationship between the photograph that I work from and the imagery that's embedded in that photograph and the marks that occur on the canvas. It's a little bit like translating from one language to the next. If you were to translate it directly, it might not make any sense. You sort of have to understand it in one language and then deconstruct it and reconstruct it in the new format. And of course, paintings don't happen the same way a photograph happens. Paintings are built, and my paintings are built incrementally, one unit at a time, in a way that's not all that different from, say, the way a writer would work. There's never any time that a writer is doing anything more than slamming one word up against the next and rejecting one word and slipping another one in and seeing how that works. And because I work incrementally, I do the same thing. I push little pieces of paint up against each other, and I work essentially from the top down, from left to right, and I build. I slowly build these paintings, construct them the way somebody might make a quilt or crochet or knit.
I want to talk a little bit more about the faces themselves, the way you paint the faces themselves. You've said that you tried to see the faces neutrally, without opinion or subjectivity, without editorializing in any way about the face. And yet, the face always reads in some way to me. I see the faces very subjectively, even though you as the painter didn't see them subjectively. Talk with me about the approach that you're taking toward the subject matter, of not kind of imposing any kind of feeling or point of view.
Well, it's not that I'm uninterested in the psychological reading of the paintings. I just don't want to lobby for one reading over all others, and to present them straightforwardly and flat-footedly without editorial comment, without cranking it up for extra psychological readings, or without drawing big circles around things saying, make sure you see it this way. I sort of leave it to the viewer to read the image. And I believe that a person's face is a kind of roadmap to their life, and embedded in the imagery is a great deal of evidence if you want to decode it. If a person has laughed his or her whole life, they'll have laugh lines. If they frown their whole lives, they have furrows in their brow. And it's not necessary for me to have them laughing or crying or anything in order to have people be able to read them.
Your canvases are very large, and because you include every detail of a person's face, every line and wrinkle and pucker and pore, every flaw is included, or what we would consider a flaw is not only included, but it's kind of enlarged because the painting is so large. And that's part of what I find so fascinating. The faces are so real and recognizable. Looking at one of your faces in a painting, it's a lot like looking at yourself in the bathroom mirror with the kind of harsh lighting that you have there, and you see everything. So there's something so recognizable about the landscape of the faces, the way you paint them.
Yeah, we don't stand close enough to each other. We don't invade each other's space enough to really be able to see the intimate level of detail that I typically put in one of these paintings, because they're, in fact, usually 9 feet high. So if there's more information than you ever really wanted to know about someone, and it makes it perhaps a more intimate experience. I make try to make these big, aggressive, confrontational images that you can see from clear across the room, and you have one kind of relationship with it there, and then another relationship at a middle viewing distance where you scan it and you can't readily see the thing as a whole, and then hopefully I've sucked the viewer right up to the canvas where you can see the individual marks and the methodology, how it got there. But in a way, what I've tried to do is make something, rip it loose from the context in which we normally see it, and make a kind of Brobdingnagian world, whereas the viewer behaves almost like one of Gulliver's Lilliputians crawling across the landscape of the face, not even necessarily always being aware of what it is that they're crawling across, stumbling on a beard hair and falling into a nostril. That makes it for a very active and very personal physical experience for the viewer, I think.
What kind of reactions do you get from people whose portraits you've done when they see their own faces blown up like that?
Well, everyone I've painted has had some kind of trouble dealing with it, and I would like to thank my sitters for their act of generosity, their extreme generosity, in lending me their image. Without knowing what I'm going to do with it, and without any control over how I will use it. They have to put vanity aside, and these are not commissioned portraits, so I give them no right to really lobby for me improving the way they look, although I don't try to be particularly, I don't try to be any more ruthless with them than I am with myself. But it is difficult to deal with, and some people have changed the way they look immediately after I painted them. They'll shave their mustache off, or they'll get a haircut, or they'll grow a beard or something. Only one person really anticipated this, and that was my friend, the painter Joe Zucker, who came essentially in disguise. I mean, he realized that all he had to do was present me with evidence that someone like that existed, wasn't necessarily him, and he ended up looking like a sort of Midwest used car salesman for a hundredth of a second. And he never had any trouble. He went home and he washed the Brill cream out of his hair, and it wasn't him. But most people have had to deal with it after I've painted them, and but everyone has had, I think, some kind of trouble. If your nose is bent a quarter of an inch in real life, you can ignore it. But when a painting is 9 feet high, it'll be bent 6 inches, and it's very hard to convince yourself that it's not happening.
Chuck Close speaking with Terry Gross in 1998. A retrospective of his work, Chuck Close Prints, Process and Collaboration, is on display at the Metropolitan Museum of Art through April 18th. We'll hear more of Terry's interview with Close after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, we're listening to Terry's 1998 interview with painter Chuck Close.
I've read that you've had a learning disability that's affected your ability to actually recognize faces in real life.
Yeah, I think I was probably driven to do what I do because I do have a great deal of difficulty recognizing faces. I have almost photographic vision for things that are two-dimensional, which is probably why I work from photographs instead of working from life. But I believe I was driven to painting the portrait, at least partially, by a desire to commit to memory and to really understand and scan the images of people that I care about, because I do have this trouble recognizing faces. And, of course, I don't remember their names either, so I'm in big trouble.
So one of the reasons why you paint from photographs is because you recognize faces better in two dimensions than in three, so it's easier for you to use a picture than a model. Are there other reasons why you work from photographs for your
paintings? Yeah, when you paint from life for an extended period of time, and my paintings have taken as long as 12 or 14 months and routinely now take 3 or 4 months each, if you work from life, the subject gains weight and lose weight. The hair gets long and they cut it off, and they're happy, they're sad, they're awake, they're asleep. And the painting becomes a kind of mean average of all the changes that the model went through, plus whatever feelings you have for them while they're occupying your space. I would hate to have the subject in my studio for a year. So the photograph gives me an opportunity to have a poem-like frozen moment of time, sort of cuts across time, a hundredth of a second. And there's something of the freshness and the immediacy of that hundredth of a second is still there, hopefully, in the finished painting, which I construct over a more novelistic time frame. And it allows me to just keep working and to always refer back to the original photograph to see whether I actually saw what I thought I saw. And I often then recycle that photograph and make many more images. And it's really wonderful. Every time I go back to the photograph, because I've changed scale, tools, methodology, working method, and whatever, I find totally new information within the photograph that I didn't notice the first time.
Tell us a little bit about the way you work with grids when you're painting a face from a photograph.
Mm-hmm. Well, grids, you know, besides being one of the great modernist conventions, the grid has been around most recently because it's a flattening device. It's a way to, you know, to restate the flatness of the canvas. But in fact, the use of a grid as a scaling up method goes back to ancient Egypt and was, of course, used in the Renaissance and used all along as a way to take a small drawing or a preparatory sketch and enlarge it by having smaller squares on the preparatory sketch and bigger ones on the painting. It's just a way to scale up an image. But and all of my work from the 1960s on have been built with the use of a grid. I don't use a projector or anything like that to get an image on. But at a certain point, I decided to let the grid remain a visible part of the image. Initially, I would get rid of the grid so nobody knew that I used it. But at a certain point, I began to leave the incremental unit to show, and I found all kinds of ways, from using my own fingerprints to gluing on little wads of pulp paper to any one of a number of ways of working incrementally and letting the individual unit show. One of the things I like about working that way is that there's nothing about the building block which says anything about what's going to be made from it.
Exactly. Right, exactly.
There's no mark that equals hair. There's no mark that equals skin or anything else. It's a little bit like an architect choosing a brick. The brick doesn't determine anything about what kind of building will be built from it. You stack up the bricks one way and you make a gas station, or you stack up the bricks another way and you can build a cathedral. Both of them will be very different experiences. But it wasn't the brick that determined the nature of that experience.
So what suits your personality about working in these smaller units, one dot at a time or one grid at a time?
Well, you know, actually, I'm a nervous wreck. I'm a slob. I have no patience, and I'm rather lazy. All of those things would seem to guarantee that I would not make work like I make. But I felt I didn't want to just go with my nature and say, well, that's who I am. I can only make big, sloppy, nervous, quick paintings. I thought to construct a situation in which I couldn't behave that way was also to address my nature. But I found that one of the nice things about working this way, working incrementally, is that I don't have to reinvent the wheel every single day. Today I did what I did yesterday, and tomorrow I'll do what I do today. You can pick it up and put it down. I don't have to wait for inspiration. There are no good days or bad days. And I'm every day essentially builds positively on what I did the day before. In some ways, I think it's rather like what used to be called women's work, that is quilting, crocheting, knitting, or whatever. And the advantage of that way of working was that women could knit for a while, put it down, go feed the baby, come back and pick it up and knit a little more, and then put it down and go out and weed the garden. And it allowed for a way to just keep working. If a belief in a process, for instance, how do you make a sweater? Oh, my God, I wouldn't know how to make a sweater. But if you believe in the process and you knit one and you purl two long enough, eventually you get a sweater. And I think, given my nature, it was very good for me to have a way to work in which I was able to add to what I already had and slowly construct the final image out of these little building blocks.
How have you dealt with impatience, though? Don't you ever feel like, okay, it's going to take me another 12 months of these dots to have a painting? I want to see it now.
Well, you know, I do finish each area as I go, so I have a chance to see what it's going to look like almost from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, patience is a funny thing. I used to work every day and make a painting every day. And now I work every day and I make a painting every several months. But work is work. And it doesn't seem to take any more patience to keep working on one piece than it did to make a different piece every day. And the big difference is that I used to enjoy painting. I loved the activity, but I didn't care very much about what I made. And now I have a way of working which, like I say, is essentially a positive building on what I already have. And eventually I get to something about which I care a great deal more. So for me, that was a very productive trade-off.
You've done a series of self-portraits over the years, and those self-portraits are in your retrospective. How do you think your face has changed in the years that you've been painting it?
Well, you can watch me lose my hair. And I suppose gone is some of the attitude of the, and I mean attitude, of the original self-portrait in which I was arrested in my James Dean phase, I suppose, the angry young artist. And I don't know, it's just what I've tried to do is construct a kind of timeline with my own image that having gone through so many permutations and changes from either, you know, the early black and white pieces or the early continuous tone color pieces, which are actually made from superimposing a red painting, a blue painting, a yellow painting on top of each other, to the fingerprint pieces, the pulp paper pieces, and then the later oil paintings, is that it becomes a kind of cross-section through the work. So it gives a chance to sort of see all the permutations and changes and devices and materials and techniques that I've used over the years with one basic kind of image.
Chuck Close speaking with Terry Gross in 1998. A retrospective of his work, Chuck Close Prints, Process and Collaboration, is on display at the Metropolitan Museum of Art through April 18th. We'll hear more of Terry's interview with Close in the second half of the show. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Barnes & Noble Classics, enduring works of literature in newly annotated editions, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, artist Chuck Close tells us about his return to painting after a paralyzing stroke, and David Edelstein on the new film Starsky and Hutch. Also, David Biancooley reviews The Sopranos.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Let's return to Terry's 1998 interview with painter Chuck Close. He's known for his larger-than-life paintings of the human face. A retrospective of his printmaking is now on display at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York. In 1988, Close suffered a collapsed spinal artery and was paralyzed from the shoulders down. While he's partially recovered, he paints from a wheelchair with a brace strapped to his arm.
Because you don't have much movement now at all and you have to paint with the brushes strapped onto your wrist, have you given a lot of thought to how much painting is something that happens in your mind and how much is something that happens with your hands?
Well, somebody told me in the hospital, and I don't remember who it is, that, oh, you'll be all right because you paint with your head and not with your hands. And I thought, oh, easy for you to say. You know? I thought, gee, this is like something came out of a fortune cookie or something. I was actually quite annoyed that they had this kind of throwaway answer for my very severe problem. But in fact, you know, they were right. Once you know what art looks like, you can figure out how to make some of it. And it's just a question of adaptation.
If you don't mind my asking, I know, you know, often when people lose the ability to move, it's through a traumatic accident, a car crash, or, you know, some kind of terrible injury, a fall. Mm-hmm. But for you, it was a broken artery.
And it just sort of collapsed.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So when did you realize that you had lost movement? Did you awaken from a coma, or was this something that came on gradually?
Well, I had tremendous pain, and I had the pain over the years. It would come and go, and nobody could ever figure out what it was. And this time, the pain ended up. I had sort of massive seizures all over my body, and then all of a sudden, my whole body just was still, and we couldn't figure out what happened. It actually took them several days to figure out what happened to me. I remember my art dealer came in and he said, come on, get out of bed. He was convinced that I had some sort of hysterical paralysis. And it took a while for everyone to figure out what in fact did happen.
How did you come up with a system that worked for getting your brush, your paintbrush attached to your arm in such a way that you could get the kind of mobility and control that you needed?
Well, you know, it's funny. I was in a rehabilitation hospital after a couple of months of being in intensive care and stuff. I was moved to the rehabilitation hospital that was connected to the hospital I was in. And I began rehab, and I remember rolling down the hall one day and seeing the name on a door. It said occupational therapy. I said, oh, great, they'll help me get back to my occupation. But in fact, it was much more about stacking spools and making things out of pipe cleaners. I must say that the therapists were wonderful people and very helpful, but it took the active intervention of my wife, who really went to bat for me and made sure they understood just how important it was for me and my sanity to be able to get back to work. And she convinced the therapist to stop trying to convince me how to do things that I didn't need to do, and to get back to what really mattered. And they found me a space in the basement of the building, and I equipped it as a studio and managed to start painting while I was still in rehabilitation.
Were there times when you found yourself trying to make things out of pipe cleaners? And I mean, because that's what you were supposed to be doing in occupational therapy.
Well, you know, they tried to get me to do my laundry. I said, well, you know, I didn't do my laundry before. Why should I want to do my laundry now? And they tried to show me how to, you know, use a computer. And I said, I have absolutely no interest in using a computer. And I really don't want to do it with a pencil stuck in my teeth. So it was a fight. because they're trying to bring everybody along, and they have a kind of general attitude towards what's liable to be helpful in a person's life. And I was looking for very specific kinds of help.
Artist Chuck Close speaking with Terry Gross in 1998. We'll hear more of their conversation in a moment. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, we're listening to Terry's 1998 interview with painter Chuck Close.
I want to say something else and get you to say something else about the current style that you're painting in. Your current painting style now is this really interesting mix of abstraction and representational painting. Because what you're doing now, as we talked about, your paintings are based on a series of grids. And in each grid... Each grid is like a little abstract painting. Each grid is, is some circles of color or squares of color or squiggles of color. And this little abstract grid, when taken in the context of all the other little abstract grids, forms a face. Mm-hmm. But the faces have become more abstract than they used to be. They're not so much about finding every follicle, every pore.
Well, it's probably lucky that as I age and all of my friends age, that I've adopted a kinder, gentler strategy to painting because I was in my 20s when I started and we weren't as wrinkled and there wasn't as much surface incident in people's faces, and so right now it's probably a good thing that a lot of that. Surface information isn't showing up, but one of the things I get to finish one of those little paintings, one of those little abstract paintings, all the time, several a day or a whole bunch of them in a day. So I get a little piece of pleasure over and over and over, and a little piece of completion mm-hmm. over and over. And that's one of the really wonderful things about the way I work. But, I didn't start making representational imagery because I was against abstraction. As a matter of fact, my favorite work was usually abstract, often very minimal, and often sculpture.
Don't you feel like you found a way to combine all of those instincts into one canvas?
That's one of the nice things about it. I was a big, big fan as a student of de Kooning, who I still consider the greatest American artist of the 20th century. And I loved him so much, and I was I painted way more than my share of de Kooning's. In fact, when I met de Kooning late in life, I said it's very nice late in his life. I said it's very nice to meet somebody who's painted more de Kooning's than I have. But one of the problems with being a good student, and I was a good student, was that I knew what art looked like, and I could demonstrate that I knew what it looked like. But it must look like someone else's art, or it wouldn't look like art. And I couldn't find a way to work out of de Kooning and out of my heroes without making weak impersonations of their work. And one of the wonderful things about having purged my work of all those influences and driving myself into my own idiosyncratic corner where no one else's answers would fit the question that I was asking myself, was that ultimately over the years I found a way to get a lot of that de Kooning color and some of the marks and things that I love so much back into my work. But now I get to use de Kooning color and make a Chuck Close instead of using de Kooning color and making a de Kooning.
Because you're sitting or lying all the time now, you can't stand or walk anymore, right?
Well, I can stand, and I can
take
I could take a few steps, and
believe
me, it makes all the difference. I get in places where if I were strictly confined to the wheelchair, it would be difficult.
I guess what I'm wondering is, you know, since probably most of the time you're sitting, and a lot of the times you're talking to somebody, I'd imagine, who's standing, has your vision of faces changed? Because you're often looking up at people's faces instead of looking at eye level.
I was 6'3", and I always looked over the tops of a crowd. I never felt claustrophobic in a big crowd before because I could always see over the tops of everyone else. Now I'm down below even the shortest people. It's given me a new view on things. I don't know. You know, I used to always sit down to paint because I was going to be there for so long. You know, one of the funny things about being in a wheelchair, is that I look out at a world which is essentially unchanged. I used to sit, and I still sit, and I look out, and the world looks exactly the same to me.
Have your dreams changed?
Yeah, I used to. It's funny, when I used to dream for a number of years, I always walked in my dreams, and I was never in a wheelchair. In the last few years, I've been in a wheelchair, and then all of a sudden I would get up and start walking. And only recently do I have whole dreams in which I never leave the wheelchair. So I guess that must signify final, perhaps, acceptance of what happened.
Chuck Closa, a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you very much for talking
thanks,
to us.
Thanks very much. It's actually very nice that to be on your show, because I now paint almost exclusively to public radio, and so a great many of my paintings were actually made while I was listening to you.
Chuck Close speaking with Terry Gross in 1998. A retrospective of his work, Chuck Close Prints, Process and Collaboration, is on display at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York through April 18th. The 70s TV cop show Starsky and Hutch has acquired a certain camp following for its outlandish fashions and tough guy hipster lingo. A new movie starring Ben Stiller and Owen Wilson set in the 70s refashions the old TV series into an outright comedy. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
Ben Stiller and Owen Wilson, the now ubiquitous stars of Starsky and Hutch, have a good shtick going. Stiller is the nebbish. He's wiry, he's righteous, and he's quick to perceive injury. Wilson, on the other hand, is the rangy, golden-haired surfer dude. He's sleazy and opportunistic, but he's so lazily good-natured that you can't really resent him. And anyone whose nose goes in that many different directions must have a sense of humor about his good looks. So here's the core of their act. The tall, blonde wasp pretends to soothe and placate the little Jewish guy while he actually makes him madder and drives him to ever more ridiculous lengths to assert his potency. It's while Stiller is in one of these impotent rages that Wilson establishes a rapport with his audience. He gives a little shrug that says, "What can you do with this guy?" And in that instant, he could seduce anyone. The idea to cast Stiller and Wilson in a big screen adaptation of Starsky and Hutch might be the funniest thing about Starsky and Hutch. And whatever works in the movie is right there in the coming attraction. The stars, the scary 70s perms, the high heels, the wide-lapelled leisure suits, the preening cop show poses, the wacka-wacka music. It's the TV series merged with the Mad Magazine parody of the TV series. Actually, it has little to do with the series, in which Hutch, played by David Soul, did things by the book, and Starsky, played by Paul Michael Glazer, was the wise-ass rule-breaker. In the film, directed by Todd Phillips, Stiller's Starsky is the uptight one, while Wilson's Hutch is the guy with no principles, to the point where he's been robbing Chinese laundries to pay his debts. Here's the pair's first scene, after they're brought together by their captain, played by blaxploitation stalwart Fred the Hammer Williamson.
I believe you two know each other?
Yeah, a little bit. How you doing?
All right, Hutch. You've got a lot of explaining to do.
I know. I understand. Look, I was trying to infiltrate one of the East Side gangs and work my way up to the big fish. It's pretty simple.
You were robbing a bookie.
That's right.
You've robbed 7 bookies over the past 6 months. You haven't filed a report, turned in any money. Well, you haven't even arrested anybody.
How can I arrest them? They'll know I'm a cop.
Oh, I wouldn't worry. I don't think you're in any danger of being mistaken for a real cop.
Oh, really? Hey, why don't you do me a favor and go get yourself another perm and let the grown-ups talk?
For your information, my hair is naturally curly.
No, it's not.
Yes, it is.
That's a perm job all the way.
Touch it.
Hey, why are you touching him?
You can hear in that scene how the Stiller and Wilson act works. They begin with macho taunts, then slip into childish name-calling, and then infantile touching. And that's the whole movie, an action stance followed by something that deflates it, so that these tough guys look like third-grade wussies. Unfortunately, Starsky and Hutch tries to be a semi-straight cop movie, too, with shootouts and chases and people getting shot at point-blank range by the drug kingpin, played by Vince Vaughn. And so the elements cancel one another out. There are no comic highs, as in a Mike Myers parody, but no action highs either. There's no romance, just a jokey flirtation with a pair of accommodating cheerleaders, played by Carmen Electra and Amy Smart. And apart from some zoom lenses, director Phillips doesn't even do much to parody 70s filmmaking styles. The target audience isn't the people who lived through that twisted decade, but the people whose idea of nostalgia is the first season of That 70s Show. Phillips' timing is limp, and even the good scenes don't have payoffs. I laughed more thinking back over the gags than I did as I watched. A cameo by Will Ferrell, who along with Jack Black provided the most memorable moments in this year's Oscar ceremonies, is one queer-bashing joke played over and over. Only Snoop Dogg, as the ghetto snitch Huggy Bear, burns through the movie's bland corporate tone. The 6'3" hip-hop DJ plays it hard-edged and slightly threatening, as if he doesn't care what people did in the 70s, he's not going to emasculate himself like Ben Stiller. And so he's twice as funny. The original Starsky and Hutch wasn't a great show, but it had a great dynamic. Starsky came out of the tradition of Lenny Bruce and Elliot Gould. He used his smarts and his chutzpah to say and do things that the straights couldn't, and he was a natural ally for Huggy Bear. After all, blacks and Jews had come through the civil rights movement together. A quarter century later, Starsky has become an anal-retentive neoconservative who can't even begin to get on a hip-hopper's wavelength. Forget Mel Gibson. Starsky and Hutch is the year's biggest bummer for the Jews.
David Edelstein is film critic for Fresh Air and the online magazine Slate. Coming up, TV critic David Biancooley on The Sopranos. This is Fresh Air. The HBO drama series The Sopranos returns to television Sunday after a very long hiatus. TV critic David Biancooley says it was worth the wait.
On the fourth season finale of HBO's The Sopranos, Tony, played by James Gandolfini, had a bitter argument with his wife Carmela, played by Edie Falco, and was thrown out of their house. That episode was broadcast in December of 2002. Now, this Sunday night, we finally get the next installment of this outstanding mob family drama. That's 15 months between episodes. In the interim, we've seen two Super Bowls come and go, and one of Janet Jackson's breasts. On HBO alone, we've seen the ends of Oz and Sex and the City, an entire season of Six Feet Under, the triumphant Angels in America, and the less-than-triumphant K Street and Carnival. We've had a war in Iraq, crowned a second American Idol and two more winners of Survivor, and watched reality TV bring us everything from Queer Eye for the Straight Guy to I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here. We've seen the Reagans miniseries shifted over to Showtime, and Buffy the Vampire Slayer save the world one last time, and the protagonists of 24 and Alias jump years in their respective personal histories. After all that, does The Sopranos still seem as fresh and distinctive and funny and shocking and clever? The answer is no. After 15 months off, it seems even better. The TV universe now is choking with unscripted reality shows. David Chase, creator of The Sopranos, stands proudly and defiantly at the other end of that spectrum. He and his team of writers and producers have crafted a show where every scene reminds you how good television can be, and how seldom these days writers and actors and directors get to reach for that level. As we pick up the story, the same 15 months has passed for the people on the show. Tony is still separated from Carmela. She's living in the Soprano mansion, hosting movie nights for her mafia wife friends and engaged in a nightly power struggle with rebellious son AJ. Meanwhile, Tony is living in his late mother's house. And if you've been watching The Sopranos long enough to remember all his issues with his mother, you know there's a lot of symbolism there. There's also a lot of symbolism in what's happening back at Tony's house. The morning paper sits in the driveway unattended because Tony isn't there to waddle out in his bathrobe to get it. And speaking of waddling, the ducks Tony used to feed are gone, and the duck food has gone bad. In Sunday's fifth season opener, that duck food attracts a bear, which Carmela tries to face down all by herself with a frying pan. The sudden appearance by the bear is hilarious, but it also has several juicy layers of subtext. For one, it shows Carmela as being perfectly capable of holding her own against a dangerous, threatening creature, which may predict what's on the horizon with Tony. For another thing, it took Tony 2 years of therapy to realize and accept that the ducks he loved so much were symbolic of his desire to protect his family and his envy at how happy and loving the ducks seemed. Now Tony's own family is ripped apart, and he's not even in his backyard, but a big threatening bear is. In this new season of The Sopranos, the real big bears are a group of mobsters who have been in jail since the 1980s, but are released at the same time when their prison sentences are up. The media calls them the Class of 04, and they include at least one old guy, played explosively by Robert Loggia, who's so combative and violent he makes Tony Soprano look like Pee Wee Herman. Also out of prison is Tony's cousin, played by Steve Buscemi, who wants to go straight. They shake things up a lot, and it's not like Tony's life, even with his inner circle of cronies, was that calm to begin with. The tensions are always there, even in the most seemingly non-threatening settings and events. Here's an average night out for Tony and his friends. He's holding court at a big table at a restaurant with a cigar in one hand and a Bada Bing girl in the other. Loggia's character, Feech, is there, and so is Tony's regular crew. Steve Van Zandt as Silvio, Michael Imperioli as Christopher, and Tony Sirico as Polly. Christopher, as the youngest guy at the table, is supposed to pick up the tab as a sign of respect. But he gets up when the check arrives so that Polly will be stuck with it. If looks could kill, Christopher would be dead. And since Polly can kill, even paying the bill turns out to have potentially deadly consequences.
This friggin' olive oil. The food's drenched. That's the reason it happened.
As far as f***ing bears are concerned,
I say get rid of them all.
They had their turn, and now we got ours. That's why dinosaurs don't exist no more.
Wasn't it a meteor?
They're all meat eaters.
Meteor.
Take it easy.
Gentlemen, whenever you're ready.
All right, are we set?
Yeah, sure.
What are you doing? You ready?
I gotta make a pit stop.
You forgetting something?
You get it. I got the last one.
Here, baby, have some more cheesecake.
The other thing with bears is, you ever chased by one, run downhill. Some reason, they can't do that.
It's the moss.
They attack when you're having your period, too.
No, no, that's jungle cats.
So, can we go?
Hold your horses. What's going on? We ready or what? Yeah.
Fine, I'll get it.
Give me the thing.
I said I'll get it.
Enough. It's done.
The violence in The Sopranos, when it arrives, erupts suddenly and unexpectedly and with no justification. You can be laughing one minute, then suddenly gasp in horror, wanting to distance yourself from these characters and from what they do. That's one of the strengths of this show. Tony is the narrative center of The Sopranos, but not its moral center. Another strength is that it's always the little things and the peripheral characters that set the wheels in motion. You don't see a lot of things coming or going. Just as in real life, not every conflict is confronted and not every storyline is resolved. It's one of the things to enjoy and admire most about The Sopranos, which is just as compelling and challenging and surprising and satisfying in its fifth season as it was in its first. The bear is still out there in the woods somewhere, just like the Russian.
David Biancooley is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrells at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, religion scholar Karen Armstrong, the author of the bestsellers A History of God and The Battle for God, has a new memoir about her early struggle to adapt to life as a nun, her decision to leave the convent, and the renewal of her spiritual life through the world of scholarship. Join us for the next Fresh Air.